we present Monkey. An abridged translation of the great Chinese classic Journey to the West, written by Wu Chung-un, translated by Arthur Whaley, and narrated by Bob Jones. Chapter 12. The gale of dark wind that blew through the gates of death when they were opened carried Liu, his wife, and the demon that escorted them all the way to the city of Chang'an. Liu's soul was blown straight to the imperial stores, but Blue Lotus's soul was carried to the inner gardens. It happened that at this time the princess Jadebud was walking slowly on the green moss under the blossoming trees. The demon escort gave her a shove and she fell onto the ground, whereupon he filched her soul and inserted Blue Lotuses in its place. Then he vanished to the realms of death. The princess's attendants, seeing her lying as though dead, rushed into the palace of golden bells, crying, "Our lady, the princess has fallen down dead!" The empress, in turn, rushed in consternation to the emperor, who nodded and sighed, saying, "This does not surprise me. When I asked the judges of death about the prospects of my family, they told me that my sister had not long to live." When they all went to the spot where the princess had fallen, they found that she was still breathing faintly. "Raise no cry," commanded the emperor. "We must not disturb her." He then supported the princess's head with his hand and, after a moment, announced, "She is coming too." The princess now suddenly rolled over and cried, "Wait for me, husband, I can't keep pace with you."
"Sister," said the emperor, "we are all here."
She raised her head and stared at him.
"Who are you?" she cried, "and how dare you lay hands upon me?"
"I am your royal brother, royal sister," he said.
"I haven't got any royal brother," she cried. "And I am not anyone's royal sister, either. I am Blue Lotus, and my husband is Liu Chu'an. We are both from the city of Chun'chou. 3 months ago, I had words with my husband and hanged myself from the house beam with my sash. My husband followed me to death, bringing some melons as a present to the judges of the dead. Yama took pity on us and sent us back to life. He went on ahead, and hurrying after him, I tripped and fell. But that's no reason why you should mishandle me. Here you are, mauling me about, and you didn't even know my name."
"I can't make head or tail of this," said the emperor. "Evidently, she has hurt herself and is delirious." He ordered the court physician to bring medicines and help the princess back to her apartments. Presently, it was announced that the melon-bearer had returned, and Liu Chuan was shown in and gave a full report on his mission.
"But what has become of my wife?" he wound up. "I have no idea."
"Did Yama say anything in particular to her?" asked the emperor.
"He said nothing," replied Liu. "But I heard a demon officer say that her body would be no good, as she had been dead too long. And Yama said, 'The Princess Jadebud is due to die. You had better take her body and put Blue Lotus's soul into it. I don't know where this princess is to be found. If I did, I should go and call upon her.'"
"Why, that explains everything," said the emperor. "You remember how the princess said, 'Husband, wait for me,' and so on. All is now clear." "Let us send for the princess herself," suggested Wei Chang, "and see what she has to say." The ladies who went to fetch the princess found her in her rooms shouting,
"What are you trying to dose me for? This isn't my home. I live in a decent tiled house, not in a sickly yellow place like this that looks as if it had got the jaundice. Let me out! Let me out!"
A number of ladies in waiting and eunuchs caught hold of her and carried her, still shouting and protesting, into the emperor's presence.
"Would you recognize your husband?" he asked. "What a question!" she exclaimed. "We were pledged to one another when we were children, and I have children by him. How could I fail to know him?" Liu Chuan was then sent for, and she rushed at him, saying, "Why ever did you go on ahead like that and not wait for me? I stumbled and fell down. When I came to, I found all these people gathered round me. I'd like to know what it all means." Liu did not know what to do. The voice was certainly that of his wife, but her appearance was entirely different. The kindly emperor stepped in, ordering that all the princess's toilet boxes, dresses, combs, and whatnot should be handed over to Liu Chuan, exactly as though he had been giving him his sister in marriage. He also granted Liu permanent exemption from forced labor and sent the pair back to Chunzhou. Meanwhile, the minister Wei Chih went to Kaifeng with a store of silver and gold to pay back the money lent by Xiang Liang. Now, Xiang Liang was a water carrier, and his wife made a living by selling pottery. They only spent on themselves what was necessary to keep them alive. All the rest they gave to priests or spent on paper cash, which was dedicated and burned. Consequently, though in this world they ranked as pious people, but very poor, in the world below they gradually accumulated a very considerable fortune. When Wei Chih came to the door, laden with silver and gold, their astonishment knew no bounds, accompanied as he was by a numerous following of horsemen and coaches. They were reduced to speechless consternation, and throwing themselves on their knees, they bowed low and long.
"Rise," cried Wei Chih-yi. "I have merely come to repay the money that you were good enough to lend to His Majesty the Emperor."
"We have never lent money to anyone," they stammered, "and cannot possibly accept what does not belong to us."
"I am aware," said he, "that you are poor people, but owing to your constant alms and dedication of paper cash to the spirits of the world below, you have great sums to your credit in that world. Recently, when the Emperor spent 3 days in the realms of death, he had occasion to borrow heavily from your account there, and now I have come to repay the debt."
"It is true," they said, "that we have something to our account in that world. But what proof have we that His Majesty borrowed from us there? We could not dream of accepting."
"The loan," said Wei Chih-yi, "was authorized by Tsio Chiu, one of the assessors there, and he could bear testimony."
"That's as may be," they said, "but nothing will induce us to accept."
Finding that they were obdurate, Wei Chih-yi sent a report to the emperor, who remarked on reading it, "Such virtue is indeed rare among the rich," and he issued a rescript that with the money a temple was to be built and a shrine at the side of it dedicated to the Xiangs. A site was found on ground not required either by the people or the military authorities to the extent of 50 acres, and when the building was finished it was called the Xiang Kuo National Temple. And a great inscription gave an account of its inauguration and the fact that the building of it had been superintended by Wei Chih-yi. This is the great Xiang Kuo Temple that still stands today. The next thing to think about was the general mass for the dead that the emperor had promised to celebrate. Priests of particular learning and piety were collected from all over China and asked to sit in solemn congregation and select from among their number one whose outstanding holiness fitted him to take charge of the ceremonies. The choice fell upon the priest Xuan Zang, who was brought before the emperor and presented by the minister Xiao Yu and the rest, who said,
"We have carried out the august commands, and this is the holy man on whom the choice has fallen. He is called Xuan Zang."
After reflecting for a while, the emperor said,
"The choice is a good one. I have heard of this priest, and it is certain that he is a man of high virtue and great powers of concentration.
And turning to Xian Zhang, he said, "I bestow upon you the rank of supreme controller of all priests and all matters of religion throughout the land." And in addition, he gave him a cassock of brocade and a golden skullcap, bidding him use his best endeavors. Then he sent him back to his own temple to choose a lucky day for the great ceremony. Xian Zhang, when the necessary seats and benches had been made and the music provided, selected 1,200 worthy priests to take part in the ceremony. The third day of the ninth month was found by the astrologers to be favorable, and on that day began the great mass that was to last for 49 days and was attended by the emperor and his family, the court, and all the ministers, civil and military. Meanwhile, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin had been looking everywhere in Chang'an for a priest to fetch the scriptures from India. Hearing that the Emperor Tai Tsung was celebrating a great mass and that the ceremony was being directed by that river float with whose birth she had herself been connected, who, she asked herself, could be better fitted for that mission than he? And she set out into the streets, taking with her moksha and the treasures that Buddha had given to her. What are these treasures, you ask? They were a magic brocaded cassock and a priest's staff with 9 rings. Apart from these, there were the 3 magic fillets which she left in safekeeping for future use, only taking with her the cassock and staff. Wandering about the streets of Chang'an was a stupid priest who had failed to be chosen to take part in the mass. Seeing the Bodhisattva disguised as a shabby priest, barefoot and in rags, holding up this shining cassock as though for sale, he remembered that he still had a few strings of cash upon him, and coming forward he said, "What would you take for the cassock?" "The cassock," said Kuan Yin, "is worth 5,000 pounds. The staff, 2,000.
7,000 pounds for a couple of coarse, low-class articles like that? You must be mad," he said. "Why, if they were guaranteed that the user of them would be immortal, or that he would become a living Buddha, they wouldn't fetch that price. Be off with you. I don't want them."
The Bodhisattva said not a word more, but signing to Moksha, went on her way. They had not gone far before they reached the eastern flower gate, where, whom should they meet but the minister Xiao Yu, just returning from court. His outriders were clearing the streets, but Kuan Yin, so far from removing herself, stood right in the minister's path, holding up the cassock. He reined in his horse, and seeing this dazzling object held up in front of him, he told a servant to ask the price.
5,000 pounds for the cassock and 2,000 for the staff," said Kuan Yin.
"What makes them so expensive?" asked Xiao.
"The cassock," said Kuan Yin, "would be valuable to some people and quite the reverse to others. It would cost some people a lot of money, and others none at all."
"What does that mean?" asked Xiao.
"The wearer of my cassock," said Kuan Yin, "will not be drowned or poisoned or meet wild beasts upon his way, but that is only if he is a good man. If it gets onto the back of a gluttonous, lustful priest, or one who does not keep his vows, or of a layman who destroys scriptures and speaks evil of Buddha, he will rue the day that he saw this cassock."
"And what do you mean," asked Xiao, "by saying that it would cost some people a lot of money and others none at all?
To a purchaser who does not reverence Buddha's law and 3 treasures, the price of the cassock and staff together would be 7,000 pounds, said Kuan Yin. "But a pious and reverent man, devoted to our Buddha, could have them both for the asking."
Hearing this, Xiao dismounted and bowing respectfully.
"Reverend Sir," he said, "the emperor of this great land is himself a most devout man, and all his ministers vie with one another in carrying out his behests. At present he is celebrating a great mass, and this cassock might well be worn by the high priest Xian Zhang, who is in charge of the whole ceremony. Let us go to the palace and speak to the emperor about this."
The emperor was delighted at this proposal, and at once told Xian Zhang to put on the cassock and hold the staff in his hand. Then he appointed a retinue to accompany him and had him led through the city in triumph, for all the world like a successful candidate at the examinations. In the great city of Chang'an, travelling merchants and tradesmen, princes and nobles, writers and scholars, grown men and young girls, all fought with one another for good places from which to view the procession. "A noble priest, a Lohan come to earth, a living bodhisattva," they cried in admiration when they saw Xian Zhang pass. And the priests in his temple, when he returned, seeing him thus accoutred, could scarcely believe that it was not the bodhisattva Kasitigarbha himself who had come to visit them. Time passed, and now at last came the final ceremonies of the 49th day, at which Xian Zhang was to deliver the closing sermon.
"The great mass closes today," said Kuan Yin to Moksha. "Let us mingle in the throng so that we may see how the ceremonies are conducted and what blessing there is in our gift, and hear what school of Buddhism he preaches."
The great Xian Zhang, mounted on a high dais, first read the sutra on the salvation of the dead, then discussed the collect upon the security of kingdoms, and finally expounded the exhortation to pious works. At this point, Kuan Yin approached the dais and cried in a loud voice,
"Why can't you give us some big vehicle scriptures?"
So far from being put out by this interruption, Xian Zhang was delighted to hear of other scriptures, and scrambling down from the dais, he saluted his interrupter and said,
"Reverend Sir, forgive me for not knowing that I had one so learned as you in my audience. It is true that we have none of us any knowledge of the big vehicle, and have only expounded the little vehicle."
"Your little vehicle," said Kuan Yin, "cannot save the souls of the dead, and only leads to general misapprehension and confusion. I have three sections of great vehicle teaching called the Tripitaka, or Three Baskets. These can carry the souls of the dead to heaven, can save all those that are in trouble, can add immeasurably to life's span, and can deliver those who trust in it from the comings and goings of incarnation."
At this point, one of the ushers rushed to the emperor and announced that two shabby priests had interrupted the master, pulled him down from the dais, and started some nonsensical argument with him. The emperor ordered them to be seized and brought to him. On appearing before the emperor, they did not prostrate themselves or even salute him, but merely asked what he wanted of them.
"Are you not the priest who gave me the cassock the other day?" said the emperor.
"I am," said Kuan Yin.
"You had a perfect right," said the emperor, "to come here and listen to the preaching, eat with the other priests, and go away quietly. But you have no business to interrupt the preaching and disturb the whole proceedings."
"Your preacher," Kuan Yin said, "knows only about the little vehicle, which cannot save souls. We possess the Tripitaka of the big vehicle, which saves the souls of the dead and succors those that are in peril."
The emperor was delighted at this news and asked at once where it was.
"It is in India," said Kuan Yin, "at the temple of the great thunderclap where the Buddha Tathagata dwells."
Do you know these teachings by heart? Asked the emperor.
I do, said the bodhisattva.
Then Xiang Zang shall retire, said the emperor, and you shall mount the dais and expound them to us. But instead of doing so, Kuan Yin floated up into the sky and revealed herself in all the glory of her true form. Holding the willow spray and the sacred vase, while Moksha stood at her left side holding his staff. The emperor hastened to prostrate himself, and all his ministers knelt down and burned incense, while the audience, priests, nuns, officers, craftsmen, and merchants, bowed down, crying, "The Bodhisattva! The Bodhisattva!" The emperor's joy was so great that he forgot his rivers and hills. His ministers, in their excitement, broke every rule of etiquette, and all the multitude murmured again and again, "Glory be to the great Bodhisattva Kuan Yin!" His Majesty decided to have a picture of the Bodhisattva painted by a skillful artist in full colors. His choice fell upon Wu Taozu, that genius of the brush, that prodigy of portraiture, that fabulous embodiment of vision and inspiration. It was this painter who afterwards made the portraits of the heroes of the dynasty in the Tower of Rising Smoke. He now wielded his magic brush and rendered every detail of these sacred forms. Presently, the figures began to recede farther and farther into the sky, and finally their golden effulgence could be seen no more. At this point, the emperor dismissed the assembly and declared that the next thing to do was to find a traveller who would go to India and fetch the scriptures. An inquiry was made in the temple, and Xiang Zang immediately came forward and, bowing low, said, "I am a humble cleric, devoid of any capacity, but I am ready to undertake the quest of these scriptures, be the fatigues and difficulties what they may, if by doing so I may promote the security of your Majesty's streams and hills." The emperor was delighted, and raising him from his knees with his royal hand, "Reverend Sir," he said, "if indeed you are willing to do me this loyal service, undeterred by the length of the journey and all the mountains and rivers that you will have to cross, I will make you my bond brother." And, true to his word, in front of the Buddha image in that temple, he bowed 4 times to Xiang Zang and addressed him as, "Holy priest, my brother." Xiang Zang, on his side, burning incense before the Buddha, swore to do all that lay in his power to reach India. "And if I do not reach India, and do not bring back the scriptures, may I fall into the nethermost pit of hell, rather than return empty-handed to China." When Xiang Zang rejoined the other priests, they pressed round him, asking whether it was indeed true that he had sworn to go to India. "For I have heard," one of them said, "that it is a very long way, and that on the road there are many tigers, panthers, and evil spirits. I fear you will not come back to us alive." "I have taken my oath," said Xiang Zang, "and I must faithfully fulfill it. I know well enough that the hazards of such a great journey are great." And presently he said, "My disciples, I may be away for 2 or 3 years, or 5 or 7. If you see the branches of the pine tree at the gate turning eastward, you will know I am coming back. If not, it will mean that I shall never return." Early next day, in the presence of all his ministers, the emperor signed a rescript authorizing Xiang Zang's quest and stamped it with the seal of free passage. The astrologers announced that the posture of the heavens made the day particularly favorable for the start of a long journey. At this point, Xiang Zang himself was announced. "Brother," said the emperor, "I am told that this would be a lucky day for you to start. Here are your traveling papers, and here is a golden bowl for you to collect alms in during your journey. I have chosen 2 followers to go with you,
and a horse for you to ride. It only remains for you to start." Xian Zhang was ready enough, and taking the emperor's present, set out towards the gates of the city, accompanied by the emperor and a host of officials. When they reached the gates, they found that the priests of the Hung Fu Temple were waiting there with a provision of winter and summer clothing. When it had been added to the luggage, the emperor told a servant to bring wine, and raising the cup, he asked Xian Zhang if he had a by name. "Being a priest," said Xian Zhang, "I have not thought it proper to assume a by name." "The Bodhisattva mentioned," said the emperor, "that the scriptures in India are called the Tripitaka. How would it be if you took Tripitaka as your by name?" Xian Zhang accepted with thanks, but when he was offered the wine cup, he declined, saying that abstinence from wine was the first rule of priesthood and that he never took it. "This is an exceptional occasion," said the emperor, "and the wine is not at all strong. Just drink one cup to speed you on your journey." Tripitaka dared not refuse, but just as he was going to drink, the emperor stooped down and with his royal fingers scooped up a handful of dust and threw it into the cup. At first Tripitaka could not make out why he had done this, but the emperor said laughing, "Tell me, brother, how long do you expect to be away?" "I hope," said Tripitaka, "to be back in 3 years." "That's a long time," said the emperor, "and you have a long way to go. You would do well to drink this cup. For are we not told that a handful of one's country's soil is worth more than 10,000 pounds of foreign gold?" Then Tripitaka understood why the emperor had thrown the dust into the cup, drank it down to the last dregs, and set out upon his way. If you do not know how he fared upon that way, listen to what is told in the next chapter.
Been listening to Monkey, an abridged translation of the great Chinese classic Journey to the West, written by Wu Chung-un, translated by Arthur Whaley, and narrated by Bob Jones.